It's telehealth for American patients. The percentage increase is being worked on right now, but it's very, very significant numbers that you would not even think possible.
So is this true? And what does telemedicine access actually look like in the United States? We'll discuss all this and more right here.
I'm Roshni.
I'm Jacob.
And I'm Kenzo. This podcast was inspired by the Global Health Policy course at Princeton University and will focus broadly on telemedicine. Specifically, we'll explore the tension between greater and increasingly limited access, hoping to show opportunities and barriers of telemedicine for disadvantaged populations in the U.S. Because this podcast is focusing on how telehealth has increased and decreased access to healthcare due to COVID-19, it's definitely important to understand what telehealth was before COVID-19 and who was actually using it. Telemedicine had a slow start, especially in the late 2000s. Barriers included lack of universal private pay coverage, lack of capital investment in telehealth, licensure issues, liability concerns, and in some cases, questions of what this technology could even bring to the table. These clips from 2015 document some of telemedicine's first appearances in major news outlets and conferences.
Video conferencing has become so commonplace that we've grown comfortable communicating with one another through pixels on a screen. That comfort, combined with rapid advances in health monitoring technology, is fueling a new boom in telemedicine.
You see massive investments happening in telehealth. Countries around the world are using this a lot more, access to physicians and nurses.
But it still faced some barriers along the way.
The problem? Only about 30% of organizations across the country can offer it.
Right now, what we're seeing is Medicare not reimbursing for telehealth services. Additionally, our state also does not reimburse through the Medicaid benefit either.
In the New York Times, there was a piece about how the Texas Medical Association is basically trying to block the growth of telehealth across Texas.
So what exactly happened in 2015 that allowed people to see the true potential of telemedicine? Well, in April of that year, UnitedHealthcare, America's largest health insurance provider, partnered with Doctor On Demand. This was one of the first telemedicine video service providers, allowing patients to access board-certified doctors and psychologists through their phone, tablet, or computer. Helping us understand investment and developments in telemedicine is Dr. Anita Gupta, Global Health Policy alumni and now faculty at Johns Hopkins University.
Telemedicine has been stepping up in the spotlight, and it's really helping healthcare providers and organizations and caregivers to better respond to the real needs, you know, and what is happening is that, you know, those individuals who haven't been able to access healthcare are now able to with telemedicine.
So it's clear that telemedicine does offer benefits to both patients and healthcare providers. However, with any technological breakthrough in health, it becomes vulnerable to becoming a magic bullet solution. As we learned about the disease eradication programs documented by Paul Farmer and Marcos Credo, it's clear that these magic bullet solutions avoid political, economic, and scientific change. This framework can be seen as a vertical approach to healthcare, often ignoring the structural issues that a population faces. So how can we ensure that telemedicine takes a horizontal approach to healthcare? Well, first, I think it's important to understand what telemedicine actually is. The Center for Medicaid and Medicaid Services defines it as a two-way, real-time interactive communication between the patient and practitioner at a distant site. And the Health Resources Services expands on this by saying that it includes phone calls, video chats, text messages, and even devices that monitor patient vitals remotely. So is this definition changing as we go through a pandemic, and how has the country responded to it?
During this pandemic of COVID-19, really telemedicine has transformed how doctors and patients are communicating.
This was largely made possible by the U.S. Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Securities Act, or the CARES Act, which became effective on March 27th of 2020. These policies have improved provider payments for telehealth, has authorized multiple types of providers to offer telehealth services, and reduced or waived cost sharing for patients. In terms of increased access, this has allowed providers to serve out-of-state patients and has granted permission for rural health clinics to offer telehealth services. With all this in mind, we're now able to take a closer look at communities that are at risk for being left behind by telemedicine.
In rural areas, the only doctors available may be primary care physicians or community health workers, which are the most basic but often vital service in these communities. An emphasis on primary care has recently become the focus of many pushing for a shift towards value-based, patient-centered, high-quality care, as we discussed in class. A statement from the American Academy of Family Physicians explains that the healthcare system in the United States is uncoordinated and fragmented and emphasizes intervention rather than prevention and comprehensive health management. Healthcare coverage for everyone in the United States can be ensured through a foundation of comprehensive and longitudinal primary care. While telemedicine does allow for communication with specialists, patients in underserved areas often express their frustrations with this type of traditional model. The specialists that live hours away are basically strangers who seem far away from the problems the patients feel at home. Dr. Sanjeev Arora noticed this disconnect and wondered, what if everyone could get the high-quality services they need from local people that they know and trust? Dr. Arora aimed to fill this need and founded the Extension for Community Health Outcomes, also known as Project ECHO, a revolutionary model that also uses technology to leverage scarce resources. But unlike in traditional telemedicine, where one specialist reaches one patient, with Project ECHO's innovative setup, a team of specialists and medical school faculty train local primary care workers who can then pass those services on to patients in their communities. Instead of moving people, Project ECHO aims to move knowledge. Project ECHO began to address the limited access to psychiatrists in New Mexico, in areas that most needed mental health and opioid addiction care. Dr. Sanjeev Arora believes that chronic illness and mental health are intertwined. In an interview with PBS's New Mexico in Focus, he explains.
Even when we manage chronic disease like diabetes, one of the most important predictors for whether we'll have success in diabetes is whether we treat a patient's depression adequately. Because if you haven't treated the depression, the patient says, life isn't worth living. I'm not going to take my medicines. I'm not going to eat right. It doesn't really matter.
Right.
Wow. So for chronic physical disease, managing mental health is critical. And then, of course, for managing mental health disease, right, it is critical. So improving the mental health of our population is one of the key goals of Project ECHO.
And one of the biggest considerations in providing mental health care is comfort. Local nurses and peer healthcare workers are best for bringing the sense of community and togetherness. The Project ECHO model, which started under 2 decades ago as a local initiative in New Mexico, has now spread to over 10 states in the country. The University of New Hampshire Institute for Health Policy and Practice, for instance, leads a Project ECHO hub of their own. We'll come back to this later to see how Project ECHO impacted New Hampshire and COVID-19 care. But first, Jacob will explain the overall landscape of telemedicine in New Hampshire.
Telehealth has exploded over the past decade in New Hampshire, which has a significant rural population and notably has struggled with the opioid epidemic. Pre-COVID-19, telehealth was being praised in the state as a solution to rural access to healthcare and workforce shortages in the industry. However, there were questions as to whether telehealth truly expanded access or not. A great lens to look at the expansion of telehealth in New Hampshire through is the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, one of the state's biggest hospitals. The telehealth center at Dartmouth-Hitchcock is a hospital within a hospital, complete with teleneurology departments, an emergency department, and a psychiatric unit. A critical care doctor can monitor 40 patients at a time while looking at 8 different monitors. Doctors in the telehealth center say learning how to do the same work remotely took time, but ultimately, they make the same prognoses and administer the same care. By 2019, telemedicine had become a significant portion of Dartmouth-Hitchcock's operation. When it launched the telemedicine center in 2012, the hospital did less than 100 video encounters with patients that year. By the end of 2018, the telehealth center was doing more than 4,500 encounters annually. Dr. Kevin Curtis, who oversees telemedicine at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, touts telemedicine's effectiveness in delivering healthcare to rural patients and proclaims it has become an integral part of their strategy to do so. Curtis says Dartmouth-Hitchcock is responsible for treating a huge swath of rural populations in both New Hampshire and Vermont, caring for hundreds of thousands of lives. An example of one of the valuable services the telemedicine center provides is stroke specialists. Rural hospitals have significant difficulty hiring them, but Dartmouth-Hitchcock can provide one instantaneously through video conferencing if somebody with a stroke arrives at the hospital.
If it was something like stroke or a patient with serious mental illness, I'm on a chair applauding.
Dr. Ativ Mehrotra researches telemedicine at Harvard Medical School.
However, if we said, more people with bronchitis are getting visits, then I'm not so sure that's a good thing.
Morocha's research demonstrates the biggest surge in telemedicine is happening in the direct-to-consumer realm. He also shows telemedicine in use is dominated by new patients. Therefore, telemedicine isn't displacing in-person doctor's appointments, it's adding to doctors' workload. This seems to undermine the notion that telemedicine will be able to fix New Hampshire's shortage of healthcare workers. This begs the question, is telemedicine improving health outcomes or just more convenient? Now on to some early pandemic adjustments that New Hampshire made in response to the novel coronavirus. Dartmouth Hitchcock was admittedly ahead of its time, as the majority of doctors in New Hampshire did not offer telemedicine appointments before the pandemic. It made little economic sense at the time, as telemedicine did not qualify for Medicaid reimbursement. That all changed on March 18, 2020, when Governor Sununu signed an emergency order in response to the COVID-19 pandemic that expanded the coverage of telehealth for commercial insurance and Medicaid. Telehealth reimbursement typically requires live video and audio. However, during the declared state of emergency period related to COVID-19 in New Hampshire, audio-only telehealth is also eligible for reimbursement, which further expands access. This essentially eliminated the financial disincentive to provide telehealth services for doctors. Doctors who never had done it before the pandemic now claim some weeks they exclusively practice telemedicine. Not to mention, the measure has been a vital tool to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in the state, prevent hospitals from exceeding capacity, and conserve PPE. Doctors in New Hampshire also commend telehealth's ability to consolidate visits, which frees them up for more appointments.
It seems that the visits, and I will concur with a lot of what the other physicians were talking about today, that the visits are much more concentrated and seem to be shorter, and so we can sort of move through the day and our patients a lot more quickly. So we are seeing probably maybe even more patients than we would see if they actually came to the clinic. Yeah, so the time that I spend with the patients is a lot more concentrated. You know, it is a conversation through video. There's no physical contact, so there's no exam that's occurring. There's just lots of questions and answers, conversation, that the dialogue going on between me and the patient. You know, it's sometimes difficult to have like the awkward pause or silence. So it seems like whatever the patient has to say or whatever questions they have or concerns that they have, these questions can be answered directly and quickly. And there's no walking through the clinic, which also takes time, and visiting with a reception or a nurse. It's a much more quick visit.
It's clear that New Hampshire's expansion of telehealth through Medicaid reimbursements ties into the complexity of the healthcare system detailed by Paul Starr and the expansion of Medicaid through the ACA discussed by Heather Howard. These themes of access and government bureaucracy tied to healthcare were discussed at length in GHP 350. It's important to recognize that doctors require government support and people need to be covered by insurance when dealing with issues of access and healthcare.
The COVID-19 pandemic has altered the way we look at telehealth. Healthcare systems have had to change the way they communicate and care for patients to avoid in-person contact. Widespread adoption of telehealth before the pandemic was slow, but because of COVID-19, the changes in policy and the regulatory environment have reduced barriers to access. Thinking about a post-pandemic world, experts speculate that health at home is here to stay, now that people recognize its power to improve patient health outcomes. The key challenge will be optimizing it and sustaining this environment that made telehealth a reality.
However, telehealth still faces major challenges and obstacles. Besides the limited access to this technology, telemedicine is not right for every situation. Many medical exams and procedures can only be done in person. Also, telehealth uptake is still limited by research-based evidence on the effectiveness of these practices. We hope to see research and evidence emerge out of this pandemic. Lastly, ensuring that this rapid development of telehealth in these past few months is sustainable is an issue for hospitals as well.
So considering the potential limitations when we're treating individuals for this pandemic and future ones, because ultimately we don't want to overwhelm a healthcare ecosystem. We want to do it well and we want to do it right, and we want to make sure that all can benefit from these great technologies in the future.
So what are some ways that we can do that?
As with many of the inclusive policies that have been implemented in the pandemic, there is a lot we can learn from them. The resilient policies and existing infrastructure around telemedicine should remain in place even after the pandemic has been quelled. Parity laws and the inclusion of audio-only telemedicine for those without internet access in New Hampshire should be extended beyond the state of emergency, as they have been shown to increase rural access to healthcare. COVID-19 has magnified the problem and presented a solution to the issue of rural access, and this opportunity should not be squandered.